WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Peter King. On the first day of the auto worker strike, Vermont Democrat Bernie Sanders has showed up to support union members in Detroit. The UAW has struck three plants, one from each of the big three automakers. KMOX reporter Sean Malone spoke to longtime GM worker Jim Miller outside the factory in Wentzville, Missouri.
So you've been here for a couple of strikes then.
Right.
Just guesstimate. I know you don't know the information, but do you have a general idea on how long this could go?
No idea. The last one we did in 2019 went 6 weeks. So we'll prepare for that and hope it's shorter.
How long are you guys prepared to go?
As long as it takes.
Union officials say they've made a counteroffer to all three companies, and they expect negotiations to resume tomorrow. Hurricane Lee isn't expected to make landfall in New England, but parts of the region will still feel the storm's effects tomorrow, with top winds extending 115 miles from the storm center. CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson tells us where.
That includes Nantucket. That includes portions of the Outer Cape, maybe even a little bit of the Vineyard. And then even as we take a look at these 40, 50 mile an hour wind gusts, that's certainly the Hamptons, Groton, and New London in Connecticut over to Westerly in Rhode Island.
Lee is expected to make landfall as a tropical storm northeast of Maine in Canada. Officials in Hawaii say the number of Maui wildfire deaths has been revised down from 115 to 97 after they found some people had been counted more than once. The military says it will interview more service members about the 2021 suicide bombing at the Kabul airport as U.S. forces were leaving Afghanistan. CBS's David Martin.
A Marine sniper, former Sergeant Tyler Vargas Andrews, told a congressional committee the Marines had a description of the bomber and had identified him in the crowd, but his commanders would not allow him to take the shot. Vargas Andrews was badly wounded in the explosion and was not interviewed as part of the original investigation. Other Marines wounded in the blast also were not interviewed. So now the general in charge of U.S. Central Command has ordered 19 additional witnesses be interviewed to determine if there is need to reopen the investigation. David Martin, CBS News, the Pentagon.
Federal prosecutors have requested a gag order to keep former President Trump from making inflammatory and intimidating comments about witnesses, lawyers, and the judge in the election subversion case against him. CBS News legal analyst Lori Levinson.
I think the special counsel is becoming increasingly concerned because he knows from other cases regarding January 6th that are being tried in D.C. that potential jurors are hearing these remarks.
This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
I was crossing the
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Wisconsin will receive federal grant funding dedicated to tree planting initiatives in the state. According to a CHAFER News report, the city of Milwaukee will receive $12 million for planting and maintenance of trees in economically disadvantaged communities. Dane County will receive $1.5 million in funding for tree planting and maintenance and to establish a youth tree crew. The United States Forest Service hopes to use the program to purify the air and mitigate heat during the summer months. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin will resume abortion care services on Monday in Milwaukee and Madison. Abortion services have been suspended in Wisconsin since last year's U.S. Supreme Court Dobbs decision, which overturned the 1973 ruling in Roe v. Wade. Planned Parenthood's decision is based on a Dane County judge's ruling in July that Wisconsin's 1849 law does not cover voluntary abortions. Planned Parenthood began taking appointments again this week. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Yeah. Todd Albo would normally be sharing his dulcet tones with us, but you'll recall that last week, Todd was having issues with the cable company, with an internet connection. I'm now thinking, Todd Albo, did you break Spectrum? Are you responsible for this ESPN mess?
I seem to broke everything else, so it wouldn't surprise me, no.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 till 8. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Albo Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Albo Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. It's what's on tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5. The Tap. 93.5. The Tap. 93.5. The Tap.
Most oil and gas heating systems starting in 2024.
Good.
Critics say the law's targets were watered down, but it will still cut emissions from the home heating sector by nearly two-thirds. And finally, encouraging news for building electrification. A new study finds that even in sub-zero temperatures, all electric heat pumps actually outperform fossil fuels. Even at temperatures down to minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit, electric heat pumps are twice as efficient and cheaper than oil and gas heating systems. And that may be why in Norway, electric heat pumps today make up almost all heating installations.
And beginning next year, a whole bunch of Americans are going to be able to put heat pumps into their own homes and have them paid for under the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yep.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Well, midnight, the auto workers went on strike. Three plants, a very targeted strike. A plant in Michigan, a plant in Ohio, and a plant in Missouri. And look, you know, Ford and GM have already announced that there will be layoffs. And this is the reason you do a targeted strike in this way. You go after the main plants, and then they end up laying off other people so that they don't have to be on strike so they can collect unemployment. Makes it a little easier for folks to get through this. And look, nobody wants this. Nobody. Well, none of the workers want this. Evidently, the big three have decided that this is where they're going to dig in. And as Sean Fain, the UAW president, said, this is our generation's defining moment. The money, he says, is there. The cause is righteous, he says. And the world is watching, and he said the UAW is ready to stand up, and this is what's happened. And you know, this is one of those moments where, as a country, we can make the choice. And I got to tell you, I applaud Joe Biden for taking the position he's taken. But this is a moment where, as a country, we can influence this. There was talk by Stellantis of moving plants. We talked yesterday about Jim Cramer and his spiel about, if I were in charge of all that, I would just move everything to Mexico and screw all those working people. This is a moment for all of us people who buy cars, all of those people who are the customers, you know, the supposedly the ones who they care so much about. This is where we have to weigh in on this. And we have to stand behind these some 150,000 workers
who are fighting for dignity, who are fighting for respect, and fighting to change. And look, this is much bigger than just one industry having you know, a labor struggle. This is about changing the course of work in this country. This is about taking on the status quo of the billionaires getting everything they could possibly want and working people getting the short end of the stick. Now, look, you know, I woke up this morning and I started reading the Foxes and, you know, the CNNs, and, you know, everyone's got their hot take headline. And CNN, the reason nobody pays attention to CNN anymore. And look, I would expect, and I expected Fox to, you know, to be very slanted. I expect the right-wing media to be very slanted against the workers and the UAW. But CNN Politics tweeted out one of their stories, and they wrote, "President Joe Biden was dealt an economic and political blow Friday as the United Auto Workers went on strike, a development the White House worked to avoid and now places the president in a bind." I'm going, what? You mean the bind? What bind? That he's going to be pro-worker? That he's going to side with collective bargaining rights? I'm confused. What's the bind? I guess the outcome in this is going to be Joe Biden supports working families. Now that would be a much better. I would be much happier with that headline. And this is the thing. This is the thing that gets me. Because the reality in this country is the corporate control of our media is far and wide. You've got six corporations who control virtually everything we see, hear, and read. And is it any surprise that this is how they frame it? This is putting Joe Biden in a bind. No, it's not. Biden has been very clear. Going to let collective bargaining work its way. Now, he came out, gave a little spiel today, said, look, nobody wants a strike. Nobody wants this to happen. But here's the thing. Here's the punchline. Here's the money shot. Here's the thing you put on your bumper sticker. And this should have been the headline across every newspaper and every news feed. Record profits mean a record contract. See, that's how we should be thinking. This industry, record profits. Do you know who should share in that wealth? Do you know who should share in the wealth that their labor creates? That's right, the workers. And that's what President Biden said. He's like, look, you know, they deserve a fair share. And he's going to, at this moment, step back and let it play out. He said, workers deserve a fair share. The companies have made some significant offers, but I believe it should go further to ensure record corporate profits mean record contracts. And what does that mean? That means what we used to believe in this country. You work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. Now, what I find interesting is I heard, you know, the broadcasts today, you know, Ford saying, you know, if we gave them what they wanted, it put us out of business. You know, they're greedy. I've heard all of it. I've heard it all. Here's the thing. The money's there. A lot of money there. Enormous amount of money. You get the CEO of GM, this Mary Barra. Now, Mary makes a tidy little sum of $29 million a year. She makes almost $2.5 million a month. She makes $557,000 a week. She makes over $111,000 a day. So she should not be talking about greed, and she should not be talking about, well, we can't afford it. Now, she says, according to her, she gets paid on how well the company does, which is true. But so do the workers. Because here's the thing. When the company does poorly, what do Mary Barra and the rest of her CEO suite shills do? What do? They come back with their hand begging for concessions. And we're in this moment right now because all of these workers have given massive concessions over the last 10, 15 years. Enormous concessions. These auto worker jobs used to be the gold standard of employment in this country. Not just this country, on the planet.
These used to be the working class jobs that people fought over. They never struggled to find workers. Now, after years of stagnant wages, after years of destroying benefits, after years of destroying working conditions, after years of pushing for temp employees, the workers have finally had enough. And are we surprised? No, we're not surprised. But this frame that the corporate-controlled media and the Mary Barras of the world keep pushing is, well, you know, the CEOs, you know, who make a ton of money, they do well when the company does well. Well, then that should apply to the workers as well. They should do well when the company does well as well. Because like I said, when things go south, where's the first place the Mary Barras of the world come? That's right. They lay people off. They close plants. They move overseas. They do all of these cost-cutting, ending redundancy kind of things, you know, to fatten the bottom line. So what? So they can fatten their paycheck. And look, she's not alone. Jim Farley, the CEO of Ford, in 2021 made over $22 million. A compensation rate of what, 356-1 with his employees. The Stellantis CEO made over $25 million. These people are not hurting. But yet, that assembly line worker making $17-18 an hour, that's too much. There's something wrong here, folks. There's something wrong, and good on the UAW for standing up in this moment and saying, look, we're going to change things. We're going to ensure that workers get a fair shot. Now, you listen to what Biden had to say. Biden said, let me be clear. No one wants a strike. Say it again. No one wants a strike. But I respect the workers' right to use their options in the collective bargaining system, and I understand the workers' frustrations. Biden's supportive. Most pro-union president in my lifetime. Donald Trump, on the other hand, gave his little interview and said he was asked, which side are you on? He goes, well, I just want to make America great. And then sought out to attack the UAW. But I'm neutral, but I'm going to attack them because they didn't endorse him. And in fact, the president, Sean Fain, said, you know, another Trump presidency would be a disaster, which, you know, Trump then took a problem with. But he went on to say that the auto workers are being sold down the river by the leadership. Now, here's the weird thing. This is the really bizarre thing, because this leadership right now was the first elected, directly elected, one member, one vote, directly elected by the members. They are literally doing exactly what the members want, which is why this is, well, this is going the way it's going, because the members aren't going to settle for, well, status quo. Now, I've heard, well, you know, the auto industry, they offered a record 20%. Their executives took 40 over the last couple of years. The money is there. It's just a matter of, what are your priorities? Is it paying your workers? Is it investing in your people? Is it sharing the wealth that their labor creates? Or is it doing what Stellantis did? We're going to have $500 million in stock buybacks, which, if you've listened to this show longer than 15 minutes, you know that I am angry anytime I hear a corporation engaging in stock buybacks, because what it says is, you have no productive use for the profits that you're making other than jacking up your share price to enrich your CEOs and your shareholders. That's money that could be invested in new equipment, better training for workers, better wages, better benefits, all kinds of things. But the choice by corporate America, the choice by corporate globe, is enrich thyself over their workers. So I got lots to get to today. This is just one of those, you know, good on these workers. We are going to stand with them. We're going to try and get folks to come on the program and tell us what's going on the picket lines. And we'll get to some of that. But I want to hear your thoughts. email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for the last couple of days, we've been talking about this CEO, this Tim Gerner. And, you know, he got himself into a little twist, you know, basically saying that, you know, those workers are lazy. They've gotten used to not doing any work and getting paid more than they're worth. And he said, look, you know, we need mass unemployment. We need to make those people desperate again so they'll go back to work. And, you know, he came out a couple of days later after taking some pretty heavy abuse because, oops, shouldn't have said that out loud. And I'm sure took a verbal lashing from his fellow country club folk. But he did. He came out and he did the mea culpa. You know, I'm sorry. I have empathy. He tried. He got the crisis management team together. They did something. And I gave him credit for that. I said, call me because I want to hear it in person. But he tried. So today, I see Drew Barrymore. Drew Barrymore released an apology video, which I got to tell you, I could not get all the way through. The first two, it's a 4.5 minute video of her, you know, doing this kind of whiny, kind of woe is poor me. You know, I make the decision, you know. Now, understand. She is choosing to put herself in the middle of all this. She has chosen to resume production of her show while her writers and folks are fighting to get a fair contract. She is undermining their power. And she's going to scab. Understand, this video was not, oh, I'm so sorry, I learned my lesson, I won't scab. No, she's going to continue to scab. She's going to be the scab that she is. But she wants you to know she feels bad, a little weepy. And I like what Bradley Whitford pointed out, because much, much more eloquent than I am. He said, Drew Barrymore would like you to know that undermining union solidarity at the most crucial moment in Hollywood labor history makes her the victim. This has been like a super tough week for her. And my take on it was, this is a giant F you to working people. Sorry, Drew. You're right. It's not okay to be a scab. Don't be a scab. That was my take. I like Bradley's a little bit better, because she does. She tries to put herself in the victim role. And this is where, as a society, we need to hold people like Drew accountable. Now, look, she's worth, what, $140 million, $120 million, some obscene amount that she could easily take a couple of days off. It's not going to hurt her to miss a couple of days of work. Now, her writers, on the other hand, the people who put the words into her mouth, and look, not an easy job writing for Drew Barrymore, who can't seem to pronounce the letter S. So imagine trying to write monologues for someone who can't say the S sound. Maybe op-agging
Stop scabbing. Writers don't need an apology. They need you to stop. But this is one of these things where, as a society, we need to hold people like this accountable. And I go back to, and I've told this story a number of times before. When I moved in with my grandparents, there was a guy, catty corner from my grandparents' house, that nobody ever visited their house. I never saw anyone go there outside of the core family members. And when I moved in, my grandfather said, "Don't you ever go over there. I will beat you senseless." And I, yeah, okay. Yeah, I was 13. What did I know? Okay, I won't. There's a beating I don't need. About 10 years later, I decided to ask. I go, you know, what was that all about? Because it didn't make any sense to me. The guy had passed, and, you know, it just seemed like the right time. And turns out this person had crossed a railroad picket, you know, like 40 years earlier. And it wasn't just my grandfather who held that against this guy, because you don't scab, especially that generation. You know, they were the ones who fought the bloody battles on the picket lines. These are the people who met the business ends of the billy clubs and the thugs coming out in the night and beating people up. These are the people who fought and bled and died so that you could get the things that we take for granted. So that when someone crossed a picket line, someone was a scab in those days, that was like the scarlet letter. You were marked with that forever. And we need to go back to that. We need to hold the Drew Barrymores, the Bill Maher's. We need to hold the View, the freaking View. And I don't care how you spin it. I don't care how you justify it. I don't care how you rationalize it in your little pea brains. It's harmful. And people need to hold them accountable. I will never watch The View again. I mean, that's it. Or I can't say I'll never watch the Drew Barrymore show, because I never watched it before because I didn't know it existed. But I do now. And this is one of these moments where I'm again angered. Because as a society, we have to make choices. And this is really one of those which side are you on kind of moments. Are you on the side of the well-to-do and the folks who, well, you know, your little labor strife, that's not our concern. You know, we're above that pettiness. And we need to understand as a society that these people who are walking a picket line, they're not just doing it for themselves. Now they're doing it for themselves. They want better wages. They want better hours, better conditions. They want better opportunities. Absolutely, without question, that is true. But there's a trickle-down effect here to where as their conditions increase, as their conditions get better, they bring people up with, this is that rising tide lifting all boats. You know, when we had a strong unionized auto sector across the board, these jobs paid incredible wages. And everybody that had anything to do with that industry did well too. The trucking industry did incredibly well because the auto industry raised wages. And I think back to my grandfather, who, when he started in his work life, now this is pre-minimum wage, was making $0.17 an hour. Shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck. There was no union back then for him. There was no fighting with the boss. You were at will. And if you didn't shovel enough coal fast enough, you were fired. You didn't get the 17 cents for that day. And he cheated you out of wages half the time anyway. And in his lifetime, through his sacrifice, his going on strike every couple of years, his, you know, preparing for that and going out and literally fighting in the streets so that his kids and grandkids could have a better life. It's a remarkable story. And it's a lot of our grandparents' generation. And we're in this situation right now where Sean Fain is right. This is this generation's moment. This is the defining moment of this time. And the cause is righteous. Because there's no justification for the auto industry to say, no, sorry, we're broke. Because they're not. They've made a couple $100 billion in profits. The question is, how long will this last? And will this get the kind of support that it needs from average, everyday working people, people like you and me? I want to get out to one of the picket lines because this is that moment where we adopt a striker. This is what that moment where we walk in their shoes for a day, where we help keep food on their table to get them through this. Because at the other side of this, this is the model, this is the mold that moves us all forward. So I got to tell you, I'm hopeful, and good on these folks for stepping up, and we'll see where this takes us. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, I want to hear it. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Quick break, right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day 350,000 GM workers kicked off a 67-day strike. It was the largest auto strike since the end of World War II. According to historian Jefferson Cowie, it was likely the costliest. In his book, Stayin' Alive, Cowie notes that the strike cost GM $1 billion in profits and nearly bankrupted the union. But he adds it, quote, lacked the proletarian drama that fired journalists' hearts. For Cowie, it was an example of labor management cooperation, a civilized affair. But historian Jeremy Breacher points out that the Wall Street Journal drew different conclusions about the strike at the time. In a series of articles, the paper noted that labor management cooperation during the strike served ironically to get workers back to work. A long and costly strike served a number of functions. It wore down strikers' expectations. After 8 or 10 weeks, workers would be amiable to terms they initially rejected. It also provided an escape valve for built-up frustration over working conditions. And a long strike served to coalesce internal union factions around a common enemy, strengthening the union's leadership in the process. For management, a long and costly strike lent hope that workers would be reluctant to strike in the future. But Breacher notes these ideas about workers' motives nearly backfired. Strikers simply wouldn't budge on their demands. They made gains in wages, pensions, and cost of living allowances. And they were finally able to retire after 30 years. But critics argued the agreement fell short of initial demands, and workers lacked more say in the workplace. This would be a key issue in the many strikes and wildcats in the years to come.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Last week, I talked about how Labor Day was created in the 1880s by rebellious workers. But I'm celebrating the spirit again this week because a momentous new energy has been building in today's union movement. Indeed, renewed union rebelliousness has put labor back in Labor Day. Previously cast as a day off, it's now a day on, rallying working-class activism and celebrating nationwide strikes by such disparate groups as Teamsters and Hollywood actors. This is making the corporate bosses very antsy, for it's the harbinger of a new order that is undermining absolutist boss rule. Particularly alarming to the plutocratic establishment is the new aggressiveness of the United Auto Workers Union under their recently elected grassroots president, Sean Fain. Tossing aside the old willingness to accept incremental changes in contract negotiations, Fain began the current bargaining round by literally throwing the industry's proposal in the wastebasket, bluntly declaring that's where it belongs. Such honesty has spooked Detroit's auto barons, who are wailing that the workers' demands are, quote, excessive. This from pampered CEOs, each pocketing between $20 and $34 million a year in personal pay. Pathetically, the corporate establishment has no better retort to feign than to try its tired old Red Scare bugaboo. "This man studied Trotsky," squealed one squeamish corporatist on TV. No. Instead, Sean Fain has clearly studied Walter Reuther, Mother Jones, Fighting Bob La Follette, Frederick Douglass, Cesar Chavez, and other American champions of economic fairness and social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, the big story here is not that a president of one workers' organization is shaking things up, but that organized workers themselves are on the move, demanding economic democracy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here we go again. School district in southern New Jersey, the Deptford School District. Evidently, they're cracking down. Cracking down on those deadbeat kids. Evidently, the school has some unpaid meal plans, so they're going to do what a good conservative, God-fearing Christian person would do. No, they're not going to feed the children. No, that's not going to happen. No, they're actually, what the plan is because, you know, they have kids who have run up debts, they're now going to either give them, there's a new policy, going to serve them peanut butter or cheese sandwiches. That's what you're going to get for lunch. Sorry, kids, we're not going to let you go hungry, but you're not getting the good stuff or whatever that is. We're going to give you something out of a special line so that we can then humiliate you as well. And look, as someone who remembers vividly, you know, having to go to the free line when I was a kid and get the special lunch, this particularly hits a spot for me, particularly sends me off the deep end, because you don't do this to children. It's not their fault that their parents are struggling. It's not their fault that they were born into poverty. It's not. And stop trying to blame them. This is evil. And what kind of monsters would do this? What kind of horrible human beings would do this? Oh, yeah, I know. Conservatives. Because, again, you know, this week, you know, we saw the Census Bureau numbers just came out. And thank you to all of the Republicans and Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Childhood poverty more than doubled. And, you know, hey, you know, we didn't even offer them cheese sandwiches. Not even the government cheese sandwiches. And this is one of those things that's just infuriating to me. Because, again, I hate sounding like a broken record. I hate going over this and over this and over this. But it bears repeating. We're the wealthiest country in the history of the planet at its wealthiest moment, and we're letting kids go hungry, and we're humiliating them in the process just because their parents can't pay the bill. Now, this is a policy thing. These are policy choices. So let me ask, because I got to know, are you okay with this? Is this something, as a citizen of this country, as a taxpayer in this country, are you okay with the fact that, as a matter of choice, we're choosing to have more hungry children? And that a school district who's supposed to be teaching, it's just plain evil to me. What kind of monsters would do this? Oh, yeah, I know which kind. The kind that want our kids, you know, these kids, the poor kids, to get back into the workplace. And because if they're hungry, they're going to work harder, right? So that they, you know, if they don't want cheese sandwiches, maybe they're going to want a little bologna on that bread. And so they'll go to work. Now, what's interesting is our friend Jordan Barab over at Confined Spaces, he did a mock-up on, remember the kid, it was in Wisconsin, who got killed at the sawmill, and he kind of mocks this, going, you know, the headline was sawmill where Wisconsin teen died in freak accident ordered to pay $190,000 fine. It wasn't a freak accident.
Sorry, not a freak accident. When you're not taught to turn the machine off, you know, everyone who's worked around dangerous machinery knows lockout, tagout. You know, everyone gets that because you're supposed to know the procedures of shutting things down so that you don't put yourself into, oh, I don't know, in a position that you get sucked into the machine and killed. And that's where this is. I mean, you know, this kid got pinned in this machine. It took 17 minutes for anyone to realize that he had gotten pinned. And, well, by then, too late. So when I saw the fine, is $190,000, is that what a 16-year-old's life is worth? Now, again, you know, as Jordan points out, it's not the media's fault that this kid got killed. But it is their fault that they minimize this all the time. These headlines, oh, it was a freak accident. No, not a freak accident. This was something that could have been avoided, should have been avoided. We've got rules in place. We've got laws for this. A 16-year-old shouldn't even have been doing the job. How come we don't focus enough on that? How come we don't focus enough on what's happening in this country to our children? Again, the people who tell us that they love the children and they want more of them born are doing, well, this kind of stuff. Now, look, I'm not against kids working. You know, my kids have always had some kind of employment. Whether it's, you know, me creating something for them or them working in a place where they learn to get to work on time. They learn to be, you know, good, conscientious employees. They learn to have money and what to do with it. You know, we've set up, you know, IRAs for them. You know, we've done all these things over the years to help them learn how to earn, use, and save money. Important lessons. But this idea that we're going to be putting kids back into dangerous jobs, I'm sorry, I'm not there. Because I know our history. I know where we've come from. You know, when we were on our Working Class Heroes radio tour, we went down into a coal mine up in Lackawanna County here in Pennsylvania. And you go down, you know, 300 feet down into the earth. Into this dark, damp, horrible environment. And I'll never forget it. This woman was standing behind me. And the guy who was giving the tour was telling us, you know, the conditions. He said, you know, imagine, he turned the lamp down a little bit. He goes, this was the light that was in, that would have been here. You know, and imagine you're a 6-7-year-old kid. You know, your job is to stand by this door. You're a 10-11-year-old kid. Your job is to walk the mules through this knee-deep muck of feces and coal ash and animal excrement and all of this stuff. And this is the condition. And you're, the rocks are sharp and you get cut all the time. And the woman behind me goes, well, where was OSHA? And everyone just kind of stopped. And this was pre-OSHA. Way pre-OSHA. This was, if you're desperate enough, hungry enough to work in these deplorable conditions, if you were exploitable enough, that's where you went. And I swear there are people who want to take us back to those days. And when I see stories like these, it infuriates me. Let's go to the phones. I've got Julie on line one from Minnesota. Julie, how are you?
Hi. Hey, how you doing? You know, the last time we had a Republican governor in this state was about 20 years ago. It was Tim Pawlenty. And he messed things up. He got us $6 billion in debt. And I'll tell you something, 20 years ago, $6 billion in debt. That was real money back then.
That was a lot of money.
Yeah. We had Mark Dayton, Democrat, for 8 years. He helped drag us up out of debt. Now, this past year, we had approximately $18 billion to the surplus. With a wonderful governor, Mr. Wolf. And one thing that really heartens me, Rick, is that we are starting in Minnesota. Every 3- and 4-year-old is going to get free daycare, free preschool. And every kid, rich or poor, is going to get the free lunch. And they're not going to have different colored tickets, one for the poor kids, so they're humiliated, and one for the other kids. No, it's all going to be the same. we've got a real hunger problem in this country. We have a wealthy suburb. It's Oakdale. And before the pandemic, they saw 400 families a week. Now they're seeing 4,000.
Wow.
And this is in one of the upper crust suburbs. I'll tell you what happened. Last April, the COVID money ran out. And so they slashed the food support. They slashed food stamps or SNAP benefits by a third. And that really affected people. And it was kind of a dumb move because it just shoved all millions and millions of people more to the food shelves. And so it's too bad that our Republican friends are so desperate to cut food support for children. You know, we'll go along with you Democrats on some issues, but we insist that you cut that food support for those people. All they're going to do is buy cookies for their kids or some crazy thing. You know, there's still a hunger problem. My church last Sunday, the social worker at an elementary school, you know, she wanted some snack packs for some of the kids. And so we did that after church. We made up the snack packs. But, you know, that really irks me, Rick, that we got to have hungry people in this country. And I really don't know why.
I think George Carlin had the best line on this one. You know, he said, you know, you got the rich people who take all the money, do none of the work. The middle class pays all the taxes, does all the work. And the poor is left around to keep the middle class showing up to those crappy jobs. To me, that's probably the best explanation I've heard.
That's a good one. Well, we got to keep our chin up and we got to keep soldiering on and be positive and we got to keep trying. I'm kind of relieved to see that we kind of barely have a trifecta with the House and the Senate and the governorship. But things are really looking up in my state.
Yes.
And I hope it goes around the country that way, Rick.
No, look, what's going on in Minnesota, fantastic. You know, the Minnesota miracle is amazing. What's going on in Michigan, I'm thrilled with. If Democrats could just look at those two states nationally and go, this is what we're going to do for the country, I would be thrilled.
Thanks for taking my call, Rick.
Anytime, Julie. I appreciate it. Thanks. You know, that's the reality. I mean, you look at what they're doing in Minnesota. You look at what they're doing in Michigan. You look at what Democrats are trying to push in Wisconsin, you know, restoring labor rights and getting local control back. This is Democrats finally finding a spine, and that makes me happy because for far too long they've been a little squishy. Now, look, you know, I know, well, you're beating up on Democrats again. Yeah, I beat up on Democrats more than I beat up on Republicans because truth of the matter is I don't expect Republicans to do anything positive. I don't expect anything from them. I know they hate me. I know they hate working people. Democrats should know better. That's my view. Now, it's interesting. She said, you know, they're afraid that they're going to buy cookies or something. There was some right-wing idiot who went and got food stamps and then went to like a convenience store and bought all kinds of, you know, bought like $98 worth of candy, you know, just so he could have this, you know, this viral talking point moment. And the reality is families don't do that. The studies are very clear. Nobody does that except some idiot trying to prove a point. What people do with that money is they try to feed their families. And sadly, what they end up with is feeding their families on some of the worst food possible, the stuff that's cheap and filling. And this is, for me, again, one of these moments where we should be promoting more generous food benefits because it's good for families, it's good for communities, it's good for the very wealthy. But we should be moving in a direction to where we ensure that at least our children don't go hungry. Don't you think? I mean, I'm curious your thoughts, because I really want someone to tell me, no, Rick, we shouldn't be feeding the children. No, we shouldn't be helping families put food on the table. No, you're just making them lazy. You're just making them dependent. I want to hear someone justify that. Maybe Alice has got a response. Alice, what's on your mind?
Well, what I wanted to say is this. The Republicans are always claiming what great, wonderful, patriotic Christians that they are, and how we're such a Christian nation, you know, and should be following that big old book of myths, also known as the Bible. But they don't want to do anything. Yeah, I mean, it's, good Lord, it says right in the New Testament, Jesus is talking about feeding the poor and taking care of the widows and suffer the little children to come on to me and the whole nine yards. And the only thing we can get out of the Republicans and the evangelical bunch is, oh, no, you cannot take birth control and you cannot have an abortion. And then after that, you know, they really don't care what happens to anybody. It's pathetic.
Yeah. No, no, that and it's, I mean, this is shown. I mean, it's shown since they overturned Roe. It's really shown, you know, what kind of lack of moral virtue these folks really have.
Exactly. And then, you know, I'm reading in the Washington Post, where, you know, they're going on and on about, you know, the Republicans did this, and, oh, my goodness, Joe Biden's so bad, and, you know, just pushing the propaganda and stuff. And then, on the other hand, they're saying, oh, dear me, so many children were accidentally thrown off of their health insurance by the state. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell are you people doing? Excuse the language. What are you people doing that you can't figure out that people need health insurance? And that what really bothers me, Rick, is, and I really hate this, is they're going around saying how morally superior they are to everyone in the world. How they're so much better. And then, but the only thing that they're doing is controlling things. Oh, no. You can't do this, and you can't do this, and you can't do this. But they're not doing anything to help anyone other than themselves,
Yeah. The
religion, and the freaking millionaires and billionaires.
You are not wrong, Alice. I appreciate the thoughts. Thank you. You know, here's the thing, and this is, you know, since we brought up the pro-birth crowd, I would have respect for the anti-abortion folks. I would have respect for them. If one Roe was overturned, because I was expecting this, I was, you know, there was part of me that understands that there's a wing of that movement that understands business better than anyone. They understand how to get into the, you know, the government coffers and, you know, get their snouts, you know, trough deep in it. I really thought, you know, the red states were going to start pushing for more generous social programs. You know, we want to bring children to the world, and we're going to, and I really thought that there would be, you know, some of it, you know, on that faith-based initiative model, so that you would get government money into these faith-based organizations that then they could then dole out the deserving, because that's what this really is about. It's about the deserving and then the undeserving. And I really thought that this would happen, that, you know, state houses across the country, we would start to see some kind of movement towards social programs. That hasn't happened at all. And I'm literally shocked by it, because look, there's a lot of money to be made by administering these programs. There really would be. But they don't even have that level of value. I mean, it's quite remarkable if you stop and think about it. Because I did. I thought, you know, hey, you know, we're going to set up food banks at the local church and we'll get, you know, or, you know, whatever, you know. And it didn't happen. And it's still not happening. There's no legislation in any of these red states to deal with all of the babies that they're mandating being born. So they're just making our poverty problems even worse. I know. The churches will take care of it. That's what I've heard that repeatedly. Problem is, ain't working. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a quick break. Right back.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that came to be known as the Invergordon Mutiny in Scotland. The global depression had begun to sweep across Europe.
In response to the economic crisis, the British government began cutting the pay of public sector workers. This included those in the armed forces. This came at a time when more workers were joining the armed forces because of the rising unemployment that ravaged the private sector. For those in the Navy, the proposed pay cuts were 10% for officers and as high as 25% for those under the rank of petty officer. As news of the pay cuts spread, sailors at Invergordon held meetings to discuss their response. Invergordon, Scotland, had become an important harbor for the British fleet during World War I. The sailors decided to strike. On the day of the strike, several ships were scheduled to participate in exercises. But the sailors on four vessels refused to take their ships out of the harbor. Many men did not report for duty. Naval leaders gave in quickly, reducing the severity of the pay cuts. But many of the leaders of the strike faced reprisals. Some were jailed. Others were drummed out of the Navy. Spies for the Admiralty went below decks to monitor the sailors and report those who might cause future trouble. Government leaders tried to keep the news of the strike out of the news. But workers' rallies against public sector cuts spread to cities like Glasgow and London. The strike also caused a panic at the London Stock Exchange.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Gotta tell you, I love the Maganomics frame that the president has been using. And look, you gotta put I guess you give credit where credit is due. Trump and the Republicans have done a masterful job of enriching the very wealthy in corporate America. They have. And you look at the only accomplishment they got through, which was Paul Ryan's baby, it did what it was supposed to do. It created an environment where the very well-to-do did very well. Now, the weird thing is I was having this conversation with someone today, and I said, you know, you go back and you look at what the Trump tax cuts did, and it took a lot of the deductions that working people used to take, took them away. And I said, that's a negative. It's a bad thing. It's harmful to working people. And he goes, well, you know, gas prices were $1 a gallon. And I'm going, no, gas prices were never $1 a gallon during the Trump years. Not even when they had nowhere to put the oil. No, that's not true. And this is the weird world that we live in, because when you try and talk to the red hats about the difference between what President Biden is actually trying to do and the direction that he is moving us as a country and what they believe, again, the believe crowd, there's almost no reality base to it. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, as I've been saying, the sane and rational amongst us have to get out and vote. And we have to get out and vote in large numbers. We have to pull other people along with us to go vote. And maybe there will be a moment where people, you know, come around. But I'm not hopeful. Because look, there's still the economic folks who are looking at, you know, the Reagan era as, yeah, that was golden economic policy. The policies that got us into the mess that we're in right now. Understand, all of the deindustrialization that happened was accelerated during the Reagan years. All of the job losses that have happened over the last 40 years accelerated under the Reagan years. It was those policies, and it was the Reagan acolytes who then came after him who said, well, no, we're gonna pursue all of these bad ideas for working people. Now understand, all of this stuff works exactly as it's supposed to. You know, supply side, you know, trickle down voodoo Reaganomics is not a failure for the people at the top. It works exactly as it is supposed to. It is doing exactly what it was meant to do, and that is make the rich richer and the poor poorer. Doesn't get any easier to explain than that.
So when the president starts talking about Bidenomics and the idea that we're going to grow an economy from the middle out and the bottom up, that freaks out. That freaks out the very well among us, which is why we keep hearing these stories.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap,
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.